All right, good morning, everyone. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Michelle Friedman. Dr. Friedman received an MD from the New York University School of Medicine. She's completed advanced training at the Columbia University Psychoanalytic Center for training and research. Dr. Friedman is the founder and director of the Pastoral Counseling Program at Yeshivat Chovei Torah in New York City. And in addition to her private practice and her role at YCT, Dr. Friedman is assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Please welcome Dr. Michelle Friedman.
Thank you. Okay, so I know we're all coming off of like this super high of hearing Elliot's talk. I mean, I know I am. So this will be a little different because I really want to do this as a group process. You know, in my years, which is now like, I don't know, 35 years or so in psychiatric practice, and about 15 years teaching and in the pastoral counseling program at Chovevei, I've thought a lot about what are the borders, like why do people go and what do people expect from going to see their rabbi about an issue, or why would they choose to see a mental health professional? What's the difference between those roles, both from the, let's say, the congregant going for some sort of counsel, and also very much from the point of view, let's say, of the rabbi. Like, how much is a rabbi a therapist, a guide, you know, whatever it is? And I think that a clarity of understanding the similarities and differences of these roles is incredibly important. I certainly think it's very important for the young men that I teach, and in my soon-to-be-published, available next year book on Jewish pastoral counseling, that's what we start. My co-author, Rachel Yehuda, and I started really with it. We realized we had to start with this topic. What is the difference? What are the similarities and differences between the mental health professional and clergy? So I have my sort of outline of what I was thinking about, but I really want to open it up to this group here. Like, what comes to mind for you as a, you know, as a topic or an area that you think shrinks and rabbis converge on? And let's take it from there. So anything, what's the same or different? Yes, first person.
Good active listening.
Okay, so that's something, that we'll call that practice. Okay, so the practice of counseling would be the same. We'll call it active, compassionate, non-judgmental listening. Is it the same for the rabbi and the mental health professional? Okay, do you want to,
I would say yes.
You think it's the same. So the actual process of listening should be the same. Okay, you had a thought over there?
But I wouldn't put non-judgmental in the rabbi's.
Okay. Yeah, okay, now why not?
Because if someone going for a rabbi may be looking for a decision about an ethical decision about something, so there's a judgment being called for.
Okay, so I think that's an incredibly important point. That's going to bring up another area, which I'm going to put in right now, which is of values, okay? And we're going to come back to the non-judgmental word right away. Because a mental health professional, and I think this is not as, I'm going to use the same one for everything, because it's darker. So do we think that in your experience, either as mental health professionals, having been in treatment yourself, you're reading, whatever, are mental health, are shrinks neutral, are shrinks value neutral? Yes, no, what do you think?
Yes.
Theoretically, yes. But are they really? Are therapists, you know, don't have prejudices, don't have biases? How, for example, how kindly do most therapists take to religious life on the part of their congregant? So I think that, you know, therapists are human beings. They may have, yes, please.
If I may shift the discussion a little bit, in a great part due to my own experience.
Right.
Shouldn't we agree first on when and where you should decide between choosing for a mental health neutral or a rabbi?
I think that that's part of what this, you know, our talk is, my talk is about, is to how to help people make choices and also cultivate their expectations and what they're hoping for in such counsel. Like, how do you make that decision? Who do you go to? Please, yes.
So I'd say a lot of it has to do with training.
Mm-hmm.
And some rabbis
Okay. 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 So, so there may be. So we expect mental health professionals to be more neutral and perhaps more anonymous.
And trained.
Okay. And we expect them to be trained. Okay. So that's an important thing. You're expecting a certain level of training. In terms of the rabbi, we hope that the rabbi is answering or is responsible to a higher authority, so to speak, and represents our Mesorah, and that the rabbi, people, as you very aptly point out, when you go to speak to a rabbi, you know you're speaking to a rabbi. So you know that rabbi embodies values, traditions, points of view. So to use an example that I have often used, if somebody goes to speak to a rabbi, this is a true story, woman with three kids are growing up, she's on her way to do whatever else, happily married, unexpectedly finds herself pregnant, goes to speak to the rabbi about the feasibility, advisability of terminating the pregnancy. Now, if she's going to a rabbi to ask this question, she knows that she's going to get a certain point of view. It's inherent in who she's going to go see. That, however, and I want to discriminate between an non-judgmental list. I think you can listen actively. You can listen non-judgmentally in the sense that, like, you create a hospitable, I hope rabbis create a hospitable listening environment, and then that rabbi, let's say in the example that I just gave, would point out, you know, Mrs. X, in coming to see me, I wonder what you were expecting. So you're not laying on the judgment, because you're sort of helping that person find their way. Okay, so let's keep on going. So the rabbi is not value neutral. The rabbi is, you know, Jewish value positive, let's say. What other things differentiate between, yes, please.
Well, most of the rabbis I've met have been very practical and helpful, and they usually encourage you to do something, whereas therapists, a lot of times they're encouraging you not to do something bad. I don't know, you're more positive, I guess. Rabbis are more positive.
Okay, so let's talk about then goals. What is the goal of the rabbinic intervention or the mental health professional intervention? And a different way I'd like to put what you said is that I think that mental health professionals are sort of in the business of symptom relief, let's put it that way, maybe increased happiness, you know, a more comfortable life. And what are rabbis in the business of?
Solving problems.
Okay. Yes, please. Okay, more Torah-oriented. I'm going to just shift what you said to making meaning. Okay? So let's say making meaning. Now, rabbis aren't hoping that people are going to be unhappy. You know, that's not it. But let's take a different example. Somebody comes to I'll use an example. Somebody has a disabled spouse, and they've been caring for that spouse dutifully, compassionately, and then lo and behold, in a support, in an Alzheimer's, in a multiple sclerosis, for a support group for spouses, meets somebody else and falls in love with that other person, and one thing leads to the next, and you know, soon enough they're in love and they're having an affair. Now, what the rabbi and the mental health professional are probably likely to have different points of view on how to handle that situation, because the mental health professional is sort of like, you know, decreasing symptoms, increasing happiness, and, you know, fairly neutral. I mean, they're not going to, a smart therapist is going to say, you know, how are you doing with your kids, or how are you doing with the community? But I think the rabbi's business is more in the making meaning of accompanying people in their life journey, not necessarily, yes, please.
Well, I kind of disagree with you.
Okay.
Because I think the mental health professional, there is meaning making is a huge area in the mental health work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it may not be meaning making in the same way that the rabbi would see meaning making. I sort of agree with that gentleman's point over there, that there is sort of a more practical, Torah-oriented decision that the rabbi will come up with. They may give you practical points of view of how to act.
Okay, so let's refine this. Let's say that the mental health professional is going to be, will make meaning, mixed meaning, but more on an individual level, okay? So it's going to, and the rabbi is going to be making meaning more in the kind of larger communal Mesorah type of way.
They usually will practically tell you what to do.
Who will?
the rabbi. I think the rabbi might came with, well, this is, okay, might so give you, like, let's say you're in a business dispute.
Okay.
The rabbi, you're in a different ethical problem.
Okay, so we'll talk
you
about practical advice. Okay. So let's take, you haven't said anything yet.
But a good therapist, if the, you know, in your example with the spouses, mm-hmm. if they know that that patient is coming from mm-hmm. a religious tradition, I mean, it's one thing if the person is completely secular, but a good therapist, if he or she knows that the person coming, who's in this conundrum,
yes.
is a religious Jew, their approach will be very different than if it's a completely secular person, because that will also, you know, adultery and these other issues.
Yes.
Have mm-hmm. much more meaning in a religious context.
We'll
and the therapist will apply that in his or her therapy.
Okay.
Work.
Okay. Let's move to. Let's open this up more. What other areas do we think are different between the mental health professional? Please, you haven't said anything in the white. Okay, like such as what?
So let's say, for example, there, again, it's like a Venn diagram, so there is overlap.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
For example, there's a, I'll use a little bit of an older example to be very clear, which is when things like mental illness were not
great.
As well known, and in a marriage,
great.
For example, is that enough for him to give her a get? Well, he might not
excellent.
And it's
okay.
Really not his, so he can. It's his responsibility to discover within halacha what he's able to do, but it's not his responsibility to actually. He won't know right off the bat from hearing about from hearing his spouse like this is not a big deal.
Okay, great. That I'm glad you brought that up because I was hoping to get there. So I'm going to just call this like the scope of practice. What is the mandate of the mental health professional, which basically is to treat psychological distress and mental illness? And so the mental health professional better be versed in signs and symptoms, treatment practices, all kinds of therapeutic interventions. And, you know, in this kind, like in the cases of whatever it happens to be, treating addiction, of being aware of domestic violence, depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, whatever, the mental health professional, that is that person's mandate to treat. Sometimes rabbis, as I said for people who were here yesterday, are first responders, but their mandate is not to treat that mental illness. I think rabbis play an incredibly important role in being first responders, being maybe the first person that somebody's going to come to, and they may not even themselves recognize that there's an issue. But if a person, if a woman comes to a rabbi and says, there becomes evidence, let's say, of spousal abuse, that rabbi has to think, wait a minute, am I in the position to treat this? No, I am not. I better refer. Let's take the situation which comes up, unfortunately, all too often in the case of, you know, some sort of abuse situation. And the rabbi said, well, you know, can I counsel this couple? Can I take care of this child situation? And the answer, hopefully, is no, because I'm not trained to do that. I need to refer. I need to get consultation from Jewish Family Services. You know, this addiction issue, this alcoholism, you know, this percolations of whatever it happens to be, you know, cocaine abuse or something like that is beyond my scope. I should not take this on. I should refer to a mental health professional who knows that, and I should stay involved as the rabbi supporting this person and their family as they get the appropriate treatment. And I think that that confusion between the scope of practice, you know, can lead to unfortunate consequences. But the more the rabbi knows about signs and symptoms, the better he or she is going to be equipped to be that first responder and that gatekeeper. Yes, you have. I can see you want to say something.
But sometimes the rabbi decides to
Yes.
Because the consequences of bringing a professional in also includes letting people in the community know that there's a problem, and some problems we don't want to disclose in the community.
Would you like to give an example of what you're thinking about?
Well, I mean, there's a big discussion now.
Yes.
Like among the Huda rabbis.
Right.
And they actually have a person that they have to go to before they
right.
can disclose certain types of problems.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say that the rabbi has to make a decision when to, sometimes they're not allowed to make that decision.
Yes.
Sometimes they have to seek authority from their own rabbinical supervisor.
Right, and I think we all have very complicated feelings about this kind of system. You wanted to say something, sir?
To add something.
Yes.
Which I've been wanting to say for a long time. Unfortunately, in more black hat oriented communities, people are, through letters, I witness it myself, from local rabbis, actively discouraged to see a therapist, come to us, we know what's good for you. That kind of
okay, so I think that there's all sorts of takes on this schema, but we're going to continue outlining what I think the more clarity we have on this schema, the better equipped we are to say, whoa, this is not the rabbinic domain. We should, or this is the rabbinic domain. So I think that let's keep on going. What other areas? There's some kinds of things that I want to bring up. Let's talk about, for example, how do people initiation of contact? That's something I think is important to think about. So let's say, how am I going to call this? Contact. How do people come to a mental health professional to discuss something? How does it happen? Yeah. Okay, so you have a referral, you call up, you make an appointment, you have like a discrete block of time. It's most therapists, I hope, do not treat people that they know personally, that they have a social connection with. It's quite classic, you know, and sort of contained. That sounds just like the rabbi's experience, doesn't it?
No.
No. Right. How do rabbis come in contact with mental health or other kinds of issues? Let's go through that. So mental health is easy, you know, nice, neat appointment, okay? I don't know how many psychiatrists, maybe like in shul, somebody will say, you know, hey, Joe, like, you know, can I take Prozac and, you know, drink scotch at the same time? But what about, how do people make contact with the rabbi about a problem?
Call him?
They might call him, yes.
In my case, I have an expectation.
Uh-huh. Okay, so that's excellent. So there might be, you know, okay, the nice, neat rabbi, do you have a few minutes? I want to talk to you about something, like after Minyan or at Kiddush. So basically, I'm saying it's like 24/7 in terms of availability. And you gave a great example of you might expect that the rabbi is going to notice. So Joe looks different, you know, at morning minyan. So the rabbi goes over and says, hey, Joe, is everything okay? What's another thing that happens all the time with rabbis? Yes, and then you. Yes, please.
Sometimes a family member.
Yes, yes.
Like especially a child or spouse.
Right.
Absolutely.
A third party. Somebody comes up to the Rosh Hashanah in camp and says, you know, Julie is cutting. So, like, that doesn't happen, you know, for a psychiatrist or psychologist. Maybe in a school setting, people will go to whatever, you know, their teacher. They probably won't go to the psychologist, but maybe something's going to get reported. But in the average daily life, people don't call up a psychiatrist or a social worker and say, you know, I'm worried about my neighbor. What should I do? But in the in congregational or Jewish life, this happens all the time. The third party concern. Somebody else had their hand up, and I forgot who it was. Absolutely, the third party, right. Now, sometimes the third party is really about themselves, but very often it is the third party. And then the rabbi is stuck in a kind of like weird triangulated situation. Then what does the rabbi do? You know, I'm concerned that Julie is cutting. So does the rabbi go to Julie and say, oh, you know, and then the friends always say, but they can't know who told me. Yeah. You know, you cannot let them know. So then, like, what is the rabbi, you know, Julie, can I see, like, your underarms? You know, I heard that, you know, what is the rabbi supposed to do with that information? And it really is, this comes up, like, on a very regular basis. How does the rabbi make an intervention about something that may be very concerning? And also, so here's the rabbi, and let's say, you know, a husband comes in and says, I'm really worried about my wife. Well, the husband and the wife are both the rabbi's congregants. So how does the rabbi deal with issues of confidentiality, privacy, all of that? That does not come up in a therapeutic context as much. So the initiation of appointments or of whatever it is, like therapeutic rabbinic intervention, is very different. Now, going along with this contact thing, I guess this is a kind of another scope of practice. Where does a mental health professional's activities, where do they happen?
In their office.
In their office, right. Again, easy peasy, nice, neat, office. Where are the rabbi's interventions happening?
Should happen in the shul. In his office, in
the shul. That would be nice, but where do they also happen?
Public areas.
Everywhere. It's public areas. You know, the rabbi is going with the congregant to a UJA breakfast, they're driving together, and then the person starts talking about this or that. Or they run into, you know, they're in the supermarket, and they run into a congregant who says, Rabbi, I need to tell you, or, you know, whatever, they're at their kid's basketball game. You know, what I'm also trying to get at is the boundaries and borders, which is a huge, huge topic and of concern, and also, there's a plus to it because the rabbi is, again, it's a 24/7. The rabbi is completely involved with the congregants' lives. I mean, the rabbi can see somebody at morning minyan, and then a half an hour later, that person can be spilling out I used my story before, you know, of the caregiver support group and falling in love with Carol or whatever. So, and then maybe Joe, who was morning, you know, davening for the Umud morning minyan, spills out his guts about this affair that he's having, and he's the head of the ritual committee, or he's head of the building fund. So the rabbi is involved in so many, and these are everyday kinds of things. The rabbi is involved in multiple levels of relationship with people who are coming to him for counseling.
At the same time, he's with this guy's wife. Or he may see their children, and
back
so he
to this,
knows these secrets, so it's this whole issue of secret keeping.
That's right. Absolutely. So this is like a constant, you know, kind of thing, triangulation. I mean, you know, we could put in like hexagons or pentagons or any level of multiple, you know, the average mental health professional keeps things, you know, quite classic and neat. Most mental health professionals don't socialize with their clients that much. I mean, people might not go to a dinner party if they know that their patient is being invited. Now, I know there are people who depart from this, but I would say that the classic training in mental health is that you don't socialize, you don't hang out, you know, with your patients. And that obviously makes, you know, an enormous, much more formal distance, whereas with the rabbi congregant, it's much more porous, which in some ways is an enormous benefit, because if Susie has a baby and she has a terrible, devastating postpartum depression, what psychiatrist or social worker is going to really know about that? But the rabbi is going to maybe notice, wait, you know what? Since the baby naming or the bris or whatever, I haven't really heard about this baby, and I haven't really thought, like, I'm going to ask Bobby, her husband, you know, how's she doing? I mean, there's enormous natural potential in communal life to be paying attention. I mean, I'm talking about the psychological life, but also the opportunity to pay attention to the spiritual life of congregants because you live in a natural community. So there's an enormous benefit, but there's also an enormous, I would say, drain, an energy drain in that. Yes, sir, you want that?
By necessity of involuntarily, whatever, so close to the congregant,
mm-hmm.
Isn't that might be very much of an impediment to see him as a confidant, whereas the neutrality and the distance and the objectivity of the professional
okay.
Is safe.
Okay, so I think that's a really great point, which kind of gets me into another area, which I wanted to get to, which is if you feel, in some ways, I mean, that can go both ways. If you're, let's say you're feeling like, you know, you wouldn't, let's put it this way. I'm going to just rephrase what you said a different way. If you are going to go to a mental health professional, you're going to make an appointment, you can do the whole thing, it must mean that you really have a problem. You know, like, that's like a problem. Whereas if you're going to talk to the rabbi, you're talking to the rabbi. I mean, you're supposed to talk to your rabbi, so it's not like as problematizing, you know? I think it can work that way. I do agree with what you said. For some people, the fact that you know the rabbi and that you've worked with the rabbi, dealt with the rabbi in many different capacities, you're going to think, like, I'm never talking to this person about something heavy on my heart because, you know, I know him too well. I would say that's less my experience with the, you know, rabbis talking to me about what actually happens in communal life. People are all too ready to come to the rabbi. I think the first thing I said is more prevalent, but I think what you said is true. But going along with that, the whole thing of, well, whoa, if I have a problem and I call a shrink, I really have a problem, whereas if I talk to the rabbi, you know, I'm talking to the rabbi. But what else is a factor that nobody has mentioned thus far about the differences between counseling with the rabbi and counseling with a mental health professional?
Price.
Well, who said that? What?
Price.
Who said price? Yes. Yes. What about that price factor?
Well, it's infinite because one is nothing.
That's right. Now, this is Canada, so I understand that, you know, it's a little different than in the States where there's national health. But the mental health professional is costly in some way, and the rabbi is not. So I'm not saying that's the only reason, but I do think that we need to factor that in. Yes, please. Okay, so that is a factor here, because even though in Canada, you know, the cost may not be the factor, access certainly could be because of waiting lists. Yes, you were going to say something, and then Donna.
Yeah, that does not take everything away from what I just said, because the involvement of money would, for me, make it even more secure. I pay, so he will do his utmost. I don't pay the rabbi. Another schmooze.
There you go. Exactly. Okay, but, you know, people can feel exactly the opposite. For somebody who is less comfortable with acknowledging, like, yeah, I've got something that I got to work on, that they want to just sort of keep it in the schmooze factor that, okay, going to the rabbi is okay. Donna. Right, right. And that, I think, goes into what we're saying here. Where is that? About, where was it? Scope of practice. Yeah. The rabbi is a first responder, and the mental health professional is, you know, a psychiatric, hopefully has psychiatric expertise. Definitely. Yes, please, over here.
Well, I just want to say, also with the advice giving, like, people are sometimes looking for the rabbi, please tell me what I should do.
Right.
Well, a mental health professional is trained to never tell the person what they should do, but in fact, get the person to figure out.
You know,
out
that
themselves.
Brings up an extremely important point that I find with training, educating young rabbis, and that is, telling them, listen, you want to start off creating a hospitable environment. You want people to feel safe. You want them to feel cared for in your, let's just say, office, in their conversation with you. Active, compassionate, non-judgmental listening does not mean you're giving them permission to do anything that's anti-halachic or whatever. It means that you're creating a setting and you're going to hopefully help them find the way. Then they say, but wait a minute, is it just listening? Like, when do you give advice? When do you give direction? And I definitely think, and that brings me to, you know, I'm going to sort of expand on what you're saying, that I think that rabbis have a different goal, which is to, I mean, you want people to be happier, you want them to make meaning in their lives, and you do want, I mean, think as a rabbi, to help people find their own way. Maybe you could say it's a kind of more, a different way of putting a cure of experience, but you're hoping that they're going to find a way that is closer to Jewish tradition, that's more in consonance with the Jewish way of life, and that your counsel, like, are you going to say, do this or don't do that? I mean, I think that there is an extremely important place for a rabbi to give direction, to give advice, to give resources, etc. Does a mental health professional do that? I think at times mental health professionals do. If you say you need to join AA, that is a very directive, kind of counsel.
But I'm just saying, let's say there's a business dispute, but it's with a partner you've worked with for 20 years, so there's a big emotional component to it. How do I handle the breaking up of the company I'm in a dispute? You know, the rabbinical has actually directives on how to deal with business issues, certain ethical issues. There's already sort of a decision. There's a history of decision-making along those lines.
Yeah, but you see, I would say this. I'll go back to the abortion question. The person, that's person who's coming to the rabbi may not know the halacha or the body of shalos and tshuvas on business rifts, but they kind of know a direction in general. They, like, most people are, like, the thorny questions that people come to rabbis for are not informational. They're, how do I deal with this? This is a kind of a divorce you're talking about. But most divorce problems, that get into counseling, it's not the procedural, it's the emotional, it's the custody, it's the financial. So it's not the actual information that people get emotionally worked up on. It's how do you do it? How do you disengage? How do you break up a life or a business partnership or whatever? So I think that rabbis probably spent more time on the emotional part of it than on the specific adjudication. So I actually think that the rabbinic and the mental health pieces there what takes the most time and anguish is more similar. Some other people had their hands up. Yes, you did. You haven't spoken.
A therapist must be objective, and he should give, he gives the same treatment to all his clients, his patients. A rabbi, as he lives with the people, there are people that he likes better, likes less. He cannot be objective as much as he wants to.
So this is a really interesting point when you're saying that the therapist is going to be objective and give people the same treatment.
Sure.
Now, right, and you're shaking your head no because, and so are you. Why? Go ahead.
Because you have to, as I said in the initial example, a person comes with the affair. If they're a firm person and they're not a firm person, it's going to be a very different procedure, and the result may be very different as to what's true for you. And so I think that you have to, you don't have the same level of familiarity as a rabbi does.
Right.
But you have to know, the same way that if you go to the rabbi saying, rabbi, I'm firm, but I really want to eat pork and I'm not looking to be Shomer Shabbos, versus you go to the therapist with that, it's going to be a very different analysis. And I think the therapist has to take into who this person is as he or she works with them towards some resolution.
Okay, and you were going to say something.
Yes, because it's impossible for a human being to meet another one and not have a nice sense, either initially or with a little time, of like and dislike.
Right, that's right. So I think in the beginning, one book that had a big influence on me was Janet Malcolm's The Impossible Profession. And she talks about how, I forgot who she quotes, but how everybody, and she's talking about analysts here, we meet everybody through a dense thicket of others. There were no therapist, no human being is value neutral. So one of the things I say to the students is, you gotta know, here's a nice little sine wave. So we all have our sine wave of how we feel when we encounter others. You're sort of listening, whatever field you're in. And as a parent, you kind of know how you generally, what your hum is. Are you an excitable person? Are you a kind of, sort of more calm person? Whatever it is. So I tell the students, you got to know, what your hum is. What gets you charged? What gets you, how you sort of feel when you're listening to congregants. And therapists need to feel the same way. That's what you were talking about. And what you need to really know, because you got to know what your baseline is, you got to know when something is different, when it's up here or when it's down there. And I tell the guys, and I literally do it, I do come kind of from the medical model, from psychiatric training, take your own emotional pulse. You have to know when you are buzzed by somebody, you're really turned on, you're excited, you want to know more, you're titillated, you're attracted, there's an erotic buzz, whatever it is, and when you are on the other side, something really makes you sick, you're bored, you feel repelled, you are, whatever that is, and you have to pay attention to when you feel a difference from your happy little hum. you know, which is a kind of like, here I am, you know, in the business of sitting and listening, and I know how I feel. You just got, you got to know, like, orange flashing light, pay attention. You may not identify it in that moment, but pay attention, because that's when you're going to get into some kind of, you're more likely to get into some kind of mess, whatever it is, a boundary violation, poor practice. Now, so I think I'm kind of coming around to what you're saying. Hopefully, theoretically, not for sure, not always true, therapists have been in their own treatment, let's say. This is not mandated by any field except maybe psychoanalysis, and that has its own issues. But the, you know, there, as far as I know, certainly in the United States, if you're a psychologist, psychiatrist, social worker, you don't have to be in 1 second of your own treatment. I think you absolutely should be, and I think that there's nothing like being in psychotherapy yourself and being on the patient side of the, you know, of the dyad to really understand what it feels like to have that kind of vulnerability, that feeling of exposure, that feeling of need for somebody to help you through something, to go into old memories or current feelings or whatever that evoke all kinds of powerful feelings. I think there's nothing like being in that experience, and hopefully that helps therapists be more aware of their, whatever it is that charges them or kind of turns them off. That is no guarantee, and certainly there is a long and sordid history of therapist-patient violations of all kinds, sexual boundary violations, financial violations, you know, stuff like that. Tends to be a little, well, and we were talking here obviously in a religious setting, but the impact, I mean, it's very terrible when it happens, and I'm in no way excusing it ever, but it's a kind of a one-on-one type of situation, whereas I think clergy and educators, when they're violators, have a much vaster audience. And I think that this kind of training is really, really important. And I do think it'd be a great idea. I encourage the students at Chovve to go into their own treatment. You know, in a big city, New York, Toronto, whatever, there are all kinds of low-fee, even no-fee, psychotherapy treatment opportunities, but that's no guarantee. Nothing is a guarantee. If somebody is like a real sociopath or predator, apropos of what we were talking about yesterday, you know, nothing is a guarantee to weed out, you know, bad stuff. But I do think it's a very big start. And, you know, I think this kind of comes circles around to what you were saying. Theoretically, therapists are more in tune with their own emotional pulses. And somebody who hasn't spoken, I want to give other people, sir, you have a lot to say, but anybody else who hasn't spoken, well, so you have two. So I'll give you a chance first and then you. Okay.
Yeah, I have a question to you.
Please.
Which does not follow necessarily from everything. Stepping back.
Yeah.
Why would someone choose a rabbi? I understand why. But if I had a problem, in a million years, I would sooner go to mental health than the rabbi, whom I otherwise respect.
Uh-huh.
It's not his training.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how, in other words, how many people go from a rabbi to mental health or vice versa? They switch back. I just can't see someone going in one direction rather than the other.
I think that people go to rabbis, like taking out the issues of they're uncomfortable going to a mental health professional because of stigma or finances.
Right.
So we're taking that out. I think people go to rabbis more around, first of all, I don't think they're necessarily going thinking that they have a problem. They're going to talk about a decision to make. So like an example that I was using yesterday, I'll continue with it. Parents go to the rabbi to talk about their kid's bar bat mitzvah, and they start arguing in front of the rabbi about whatever, how much the kid should do, what their expectations are, and the rabbi realizes, and the rabbi knows that this kid, let's say the rabbi knows the kid from whatever it is, junior congregation, from camp, from something, and sort of is thinking like, oh, now I understand a little bit more about why this child may be exhibiting certain kinds of behaviors or having certain kinds of problems, because look at what's going on with the parents. So maybe the rabbi, this kind of comes back to
how the rabbi sees something going on. Or like my example before, the rabbi sees Joe in morning minyan and sees that Joe is really looking poorly and different from the way Joe usually looks, not as groomed, as lost weight. The rabbi is thinking, what's going on? Is Joe physically ill? Is Joe having a depression? Is something? So the rabbi may be making an intervention. So but you're talking about why people, so the rabbi may say, hey, Joe, you know, let's sit down for a moment. Like, you know, I'm kind of, you look sort of different. What's going on? And that may be sort of stumbling into a whole thing. But why a person would actually go to the rabbi, I think it would be often about like life transition times. Rabbi is very involved, for example. People go to a rabbi about to be, you know, for a premarital discussion, like to be their Masada Kedushin. Hopefully any rabbi who's doing that is sitting down with this couple, not just to talk about like which caterer are you using and what color are the table. Obviously the rabbi's not talking about that, but you know, like talking about the actual planning of the wedding, but is talking about their relationship a little bit and how they, what are their hopes, and is talking about genetic counseling or talking about other stuff. And then things come up in the way of that. Certainly around death and mourning, rabbis have enormous impact, you know, on family issues. So,
but it's more like someone would come to me and say, "Listen, I'm really in a bad shape. What mm-hmm. should I do?" To me, there's no contender.
I respect that, but I think a lot of people do see their rabbi as a meaning-making person. Like, let's say for those of us, I guess we were all at Elliot's talk before. Let's say somebody really has, you know, a crisis of faith around something.
That's different.
But
okay.
Is it different? Some people, I mean, the average person is probably not going to call up a psychiatrist for a crisis of faith issue, but they may be experiencing it as a kind of a sadness or a kind of an apathy. And then they, as they're talking about it, they realize, oh, you know, like, I mean, not in the first minute they're not going to realize this, but it may, these things can converge. I don't think that they're, people don't, you know, we have like, I don't feel good. You don't know why you don't feel good. I feel like something, I'm missing something. I've lost something. I don't feel as interested in stuff. Like people sort of know how they feel. They don't really know which bucket, you know, it's in. Sir, you had, you're good? Okay, let's see. Yes, in the back, and then you. Yes.
We're talking about a rabbi who, I'm assuming, I have been assuming, if you're talking about a rabbi who has training in pastoral counseling, not someone
good luck. Yeah.
Oh,
yes, one of my favorite topics. Right, does that whole notion, Das Torah, if you are steeped in all kinds of traditional texts, does that give you adequate knowledge to advise somebody on which surgeon to use? I don't know. You know, I think I would... Well, I don't, you know, I think that it's important. I think Das Torah would, you know, to me, in its most elevated form, would give a rabbi humility and the awareness to seek counsel about things that he or she just doesn't know from their training. Well, that, you know, I mean, I'm
anything is a negative correlation.
Well, that's, you know, history has a lot of sorry examples in that way, and you know, that's, I think that, as I said, I hope Das Torah would lead people to want to be steeped in other kinds of knowledge. Yes, you in the front, you had your hand up.
I was just thinking about anxieties that you seek counseling for. So anxiety is based on ethical issues up the rabbi's alley.
Okay. Can you have an example that you want to bring up?
Anxieties over the ethics of, say, you're a boss and you're firing somebody.
Great.
But you're going to be denying somebody a job.
Great.
You want ethical guidance in how to approach this.
Okay, excellent.
For example, but anxiety is created because you feel badly about yourself and feel less knowledgeable about something. That kind of anxiety may be better helped by a mental health professional.
And I think that intersection would be like a beautiful thing. I remember many years ago, we had this series of programs at Lincoln Square, and it was called Religion on the Job. And they took different kinds of jobs, like business or law or medicine or fine, whatever it would be, and try to explore, you know, these kind of bigger categories of ethical religious dilemmas and work them through. And I think that was, you know, it was sort of like what Elliot just did before, and I was very moved by what he did, but saying like, let's dial this back to really core experiences that we have in our lives. You know, what is, now there is a whole lore and there's a whole thing about like, well, what are Jewish religious attitudes towards child rearing? Or what are Jewish religious attitudes towards having difficult parents? You know, like things that we're all living with, and how do you deal with that? What does our tradition have to say? Sir, you want to say something?
Well,
saying that any time you're asking somebody for help, you kind of work, like the person was saying before, on a power relationship, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you ask your boss for help, it's different than if you ask your wife for help, or if you ask your child for help. There's different power levels.
Absolutely.
And so I can see why a woman who maybe feels in the scheme of things in the synagogue, she is at a much lower power level. She doesn't feel comfortable broaching like a small issue with the rabbi. So the thing is, the rabbis are very male-oriented. I mean, luckily we have rabbis.
Uh-huh.
Who sometimes handle things. So the thing is, we have to kind of say, what is the relationship between the two people before?
Uh-huh.
Like if you're a guy who goes to the minyan all the time,
right,
and you're always chatting with the rabbi about various things, it's no problem asking him about something outside of that.
That's right.
But somebody who sees him as like the head of the synagogue and never, or she never talks to him except, you know. So that's the problem. A rabbi, we're lucky we have a very approachable rabbi at our shul, but I'm just saying, a lot of rabbis are not as easy to approach.
Okay,
it's not favoritism, but obviously somebody that he participates in the minyan on a regular basis,
right,
becomes someone that he's much more comfortable with, and you can do more stuff better.
Okay, so I think that's a really great point, and I just put it in, it was something I was had on my little sheet here that I want, kind of like, I put under like locus of authority, that there, you know, is it, like, what is the basis of authority and how is authority dispensed? And a big thing that follows from what you said very eloquently is, what are the borders and boundaries of authority? And I think unless you have this stuff clearly thought through, that's over here, what constitutes a boundary violation? And all of this stuff is very densely packed together. We're getting close to the end of time, and I see my boss coming in. Okay, please, go ahead. A few minutes, all right.
So, I mean, I think on that note, to tie in what you said about third parties.
Yes.
Oftentimes, like, a child maybe is interested in religion, and the father will drag him to the rabbi, and the rabbi really is close with the father, and really has vested interest in keeping the kid, and it becomes like the father's kind of recruiting somebody to attack his kid, or in a marriage.
Yes.
You know, about a woman who had two difficult pregnancies in her 30s. She was 40. And the guy asked the rabbi, oh, well, shouldn't we have another kid? And the rabbi was like, go, it'll be great. And the wife didn't want, go, it'll be great. I'm looking forward to being invited to the bris.
Right. See, I think that, you know, I cannot emphasize, I put it in the center, that's good. I think that it's so critical, if the rabbi can remember in the rabbi's mind to say, I am the rabbi to all of these people, and the rabbi, and they're not all going to be happy. And that's real life, but the rabbi has to be true to that relationship with all of them. I mean, in the case that you just mentioned, the rabbi has to really honestly say to the woman, tell me what you're thinking and feeling, and have that in some kind of discussion. Because I have seen the opposite story exactly, where a woman has had really medically threatening pregnancies and wants to have another one, and the husband is saying, or they're just maxed out financially. This has happened a number of times with Haredi consultations, where people have quite a number of children, and you know, one person, let's say in this case, a wife wants to have more. I'm thinking about a case, and the husband says, no, I you know, we are good, we are done. And so that's another permutation of the same thing. Yes, please.
Just don't have a rapport, and because I'm addressing the question, why would you go to your rabbi, or why would you go back? Let's say your rabbi does have some training, which some rabbis do in that area, even mental health training, or you have a good rapport. You may choose to go back to your rabbi, even for some form of...
Totally. I mean, the notion that mental health professionals value neutral, like somebody brought up the question before about value neutral regarding gay and lesbian issues. So let's say somebody's an Orthodox Jew and is struggling with his or her homosexuality and wants to come out, or whatever the story is, goes to a therapist, a secular therapist, who says, like, what? This is, you know, 2015. Like, why is this a problem? This shouldn't, I mean, maybe in his or her head they're saying that, but if they're not appreciating that this is a cultural clash, that this is not a simple thing, that is not going to be, you're not going to have an empathic, resonant, useful therapeutic relationship. I mean, just as if some of this we could have gone into this, but I didn't want to really necessarily make it. Seems, I think it flows. The whole issue of should your therapist be Orthodox? That's something that people ask me, or, you know, it comes up from time to time. I wrote a piece about this in Jewish Action some time ago. You know, do you have to have somebody who's of the same persuasion, whatever it is? You know, should an African-American, African-Canadian, I should say, have an African-Canadian therapist? You know, do gay people want gay therapists? Do Jews want Jewish therapists? I mean, hopefully we could have some kind of bandwidth of the human experience and be able to respect ideologies that are maybe different than our own practice. I mean, I see Haredi patients, and I'm not, you know, they walk into the office, they can see in 1 second that I'm not in the same ballpark as them, but I can understand, you know, what their frame of reference is. Any other, yes, please, you haven't spoken much.
I'm under the care of mental health professionals, and I'm waiting for my rabbi to figure out that what he should be providing me is spiritual counseling,
mm-hmm.
and he's not.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I mean, I'm not asking,
right.
I'm just saying, my expectation,
right.
I don't know the mental health people for a completely different
uh-huh.
reason,
uh-huh.
but it is clear to the rabbi that I'm under
mm-hmm.
stress,
mm-hmm.
and I'm trying to figure out why a rabbi who presumably has been trained, and I'm not in an Orthodox community,
mm-hmm.
Who has been trained to recognize
mm.
that, you know, people are looking for spiritual meaning, so I'm right back to the giving meaning, and I'm
great.
Saying, like, where did this guy go to school?
Right, and I think
I don't think I should
great.
Have to tell him
right.
this is his job.
Right.
And so what I'm doing
right.
is I'm looking for it elsewhere in the Jewish community.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Another rabbi.
Okay, so my favorite writer in this topic is Henri Nouwen, who was a Dutch Catholic priest.
Oh.
And his, somebody knows this, The Wounded Healer. That article, The Wounded Healer, is really, it's actually the book is called The Wounded Healer, but that's the best essay in it. The Wounded Healer really talks about how a spiritual leader, he was a guy who struggled with depression a great deal, uses their own spiritual suffering to help others, not in an exhibitionistic sharing way. He's like, he is not encouraging they believe in his case, well, the priest or the clergy person to share, but to use it to inform. I hope that, you know, in my closing seconds here, I guess, I hope that this would give rise to maybe panels in your various synagogues or institutions that have mental health professionals and clergy together talking about where is the intersection of mental health experiences, suffering, and meaning. You know, what can we learn from this? Because I fundamentally believe that the rabbi is a first responder, and the rabbi is the person who hopefully is going to accompany the congregant along the journey of illness, hopefully recovery, wherever it goes, but to help them integrate it into some kind of meaningful, a whole way. Because we don't cure a lot of stuff. We accompany people as they're going through it. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I hope that this has been...